Hi, I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, host of the Above Average Intelligence podcast here on the DSR Network. Every Monday, I speak with journalists, authors, and of course, actual former intelligence officers, spies like myself, for a look at current events from the perspective of the intelligence community. If that sounds good to you, then please consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Members of the DSR Network gain access to exclusive content, access to the DSR Slack and Discord communities, expanded show notes for select episodes, and more. All of this for just $7 a month or $70 for a year. As a thank you for listening, I'm offering 25% off the regular membership price. Please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code Intel. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code Intel.
This is Above Average Intelligence, a production of the DSR Network. Each week, hosts Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf are joined by leading experts from the intelligence community for expert analysis on the biggest security challenges around the world.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, and this is DSR's Above Average Intelligence Show. I'm very happy to welcome today as my guest, Mr. Mick Mulroy, a great friend of mine. Got to always throw that in there. Former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East, serving under Secretary James Mattis and Secretary Mark Esper. He was responsible for representing the DOD for defense policy and for Middle East policy in the interagency. He's also a retired CIA officer, paramilitary officer, former chief of station. And of course, if I leave this out, you will never forgive me, a former U.S. Marine. After leaving the Pentagon, he co-founded the Lobo Institute. He is an ABC News national security analyst, does a whole bunch of stuff. Great friend of mine, one of the heroes of CIA and the national security community. I know he'll hate me saying that. Mick, thanks so much for coming on.
Great to be with you as usual, Mark.
So we're gonna go over a couple things. We're gonna talk about the current events with Iran, talk about the Gaza Pier operation. Maybe we'll get into a little bonus content with stoicism, one of your favorite things. But first of all,
that's right.
As you and I certainly have been busy the last couple of days in the Middle East, what the hell just happened?
I know, right? Yes, unprecedented, as you know, Iran directly attacking Israel, which is significant. I mean, even if it was a complete, you know, from a military perspective, failure. Although I have to say, I do a lot of Middle East media, and it's almost puzzling to see how they're trying to couch this as a victory. It's almost like you know, I used to be a boxing coach, like a guy jumped in the ring, threw 300 Hail Marys, landed none, and then declares victory. And I don't mean to make a light of it. It's significant, right? But that part was a little puzzling. But obviously, if Israel, the U.S., the U.K., France, and some Arab partners would have been successful shooting down these over 320 total between cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and drones, it would have caused major devastation. So I think that is part of the calculation of what Israel's looking at right now, as we speak, on whether to respond inside Iran so they don't create this paradigm that they attack IRGC Quds Force officers, who, as you know, are primarily responsible for dealing with the proxies that attack Israel and the United States. And that somehow greenlights Iran to be able to directly attack Israel. So I think they will likely want to take a strike in Iran. The question will be, what will be the targets? How significant will it be? How much influence will the U.S. and France and other European countries have to try to mitigate this not escalating? That's a lot of to be determined, and I think that's part of the calculation right now.
Do you think that, especially as we saw the events play out, and I think I tend to agree. I don't think it was the Iranian attack was performative. I mean, when you have these waves, it's actually similar to Russian modus operandi in Ukraine. Yes. But you have slow drones followed by cruise missiles followed by ballistic missiles. You know, you are putting a lot in air defense, in a defensive posture, so that one of these doesn't get through. In some sense, you know, I think that the Israeli response certainly will be determined now by the lack of casualties. You know, you think about the ferocity after October 7th, 1,200 Israelis killed. Well, you don't have that here. So it's almost, in my view, that the Israeli government has a bit of luxury and time. You and I were joking before the show is that perhaps a de-escalatory move is actually Israeli covert action. which, you know, when we're saying that, hey, it's a good thing if they go on a campaign of assassin cyber. But talk to us a little bit about that, what that would mean. And is that something that you're looking at, too, as one of the Israeli options?
Yes, but I'd like to point out what you pointed out is really important, because a lot of people aren't picking that up. A lot of people are saying, well, they sent these slow moving drones at first that everybody knew would be shot down. But the sequence you just said and the way they did it was designed so that it would all be hitting Israel at the same time because of the speed. Obviously, drones are slower than cruise missiles and then obviously ballistic missiles. So I think, you know, people give them too much credit thinking they were just hoping they'd get shot down. But I just, that's an important point. Some people aren't making it. I do agree. And you told me this morning, you know, in a joking kind of way that you mentioned that. I did too. And it's like, well, yeah, I guess some people wouldn't think that's de-escalatory. But I do, because, I mean, a lot of this stuff is face-saving, right? So if, you know, and it was quite frankly why I thought we should have done Qasem Soleimani under Title 50, right? Not get on to do a press conference about it. Now, granted, you know, we could have said, well, maybe, you know, he stepped on a mine. It was an errant rocket. Who knows? People would have saw through it. But when you get on and are boisterous about it and braggadocious, especially in the Arab world, but I think everywhere, or the Middle East, I should say, obviously the Iranians are Persian, especially with the Iranians, they feel like they have to respond. And sometimes when it's covert, you don't claim it, it's not, they have a different calculation. They'll either do it covertly, or they won't consider it necessary to respond. They'll use proxies, which they usually do, right? But they won't feel the need to launch 300 projectiles in a very open, obvious, and risking a major escalation should the Israelis then potentially, because we talked about some of what they could do, but they might just decide to take this opportunity to destroy or at least degrade their nuclear facilities, or suspected ones, I should say, right? So this could be a big strategic mistake on the side of Iran. But I do agree, and I've said it, that I think Israel should. Well, I do think that they'll likely do some kind of a overt strike. But I would do most of my actions, you know, under the table. Yeah, absolutely.
After I said this yesterday, I think you'll agree. Right now, we have two former CIA guys. Someone said to me, it was a member of Congress who sent me a quick note, who heard my comments on this. They said, you know, the CIA is always going to be doing CIA things. So that's just the way we think. I think there's something you can kind of provide to the listeners that's quite unique, because as you know, obviously you and I have been friends from CIA, but you had an incredible job in the Pentagon as the DASD for the Middle East. And one of the things that I believe you were working on at the time, and which really came to fruition, is this incredible, you know, anti-Iran regional security architecture. And that doesn't just mean the United States and Israel; it means the Sunni Arab states. And what we saw the other day was both Jordan and Saudi Arabia take action. It almost validates some of the things that I think you probably were working on. And to me, it gives us a little hope for the future. I mean, despite the absolute diplomatic freeze on Israel and the Arab world overtly, I think behind the scenes, the security ties between Israel and Jordan, Israel and Saudi are fine. And this, to me, certainly demonstrated that. But talk to us a little bit about that security, you know, architecture that you helped build and how it seemed to hold and what it means for the future.
Yes, that's a good point, Mark. So it was called the Middle East Security Alliance, so the MESA. It was, I think, when it came to my part of it, it was pushing against an open door. It was basically, there was several components. There was the national defense or defense, there was economic, and there was a political component. And because we grouped them together, I think the long pole in the tent was the economic, because there were such discrepancies in economies, et cetera. The security part, I think, was a no-brainer. Under that, we had like five major components that we wanted to really focus on. Counterterrorism, obviously, border security, maritime free navigation. I might be missing one, but one of the biggest, as we see here, was air and missile defense, right? An integrated air and missile defense. And there was a fifth one. I just can't remember. It'll come to me. But that was in air, just air, period, integrated Air Force components. But that was not the issue. In fact, all countries that I talked to, with was essentially everybody but the problematic ones like Iran, were interested in doing that because they were the threats that Secretary Mattis had identified from Iran, to be quite frank. So that was to your point, that was something that we're seeing the fruitions of now, because although it didn't move out together, different components did. And we obviously saw the Abraham Accords for the diplomatic side and had some success. But the military integration side, we now see as the International Maritime Security Construct, or Prosperity Guardianship, which is a coalition to try to keep the waterways open in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. And then we're seeing the air and missile defense, which I think in a lot of countries aren't even indicating how much they did play in helping shoot these down. And I brought it up with one of those countries' representative, and he was doing a tap dance. And I wish I wouldn't have brought it up, because I was trying to give him a compliment, but he did not want the compliment. But I think it's important to note that it's not just the actual act of shooting down a missile, which is obviously the key last component, but the phased array radar, the intelligence, everything that goes into seeing it as soon as it's up in the air and trying to predict where it's going to be. And that has really helped, I think, in spades when it came to this event.
You know, in some ways, and, you know, as you think about if ever Gaza, if when I say we can get past Gaza, but if Gaza winds down, you know, I think people may look to the events of what happened in terms of this integrated security architecture as you know, the possibilities for the future. I mean, you know, if you think about it, I remember talking to Jordanian King Abdullah, you know, years ago, and he always talked about this kind of alliance against the Shia Crescent. And ultimately this would kind of play into a future normalization deal with Saudi Arabia. I mean, I think it's a bit of a pipe dream now. You know, Gaza's a mess and I'm not sure how we get past that. But to me, this does show that there's a lot more that goes on under the table, and I think that that was certainly on display. And you know, the last part too is you do wonder. I mean, you know, would this have been so successful, the defensive posture, without the help of the Arab states? You know, perhaps not. So that's certainly a good thing. Last piece on this, and I thought it was kind of interesting, is, you know, obviously President Biden, you know, has called on Netanyahu and the Israelis to, you know, quote, take a win here. And so that is a direct plea from the United States. One thing that I've been trying to point out is, you know, and you know this from your time, the Israelis don't, of course, always listen. And I think that for American policymakers, at least those, you know, certainly like yourself, who spent a lot of time in the region, you were in the intelligence world and then became, in essence, a policymaker. But I think we understand that. And I remember back in 2007 when the Israelis bombed a North Korean-built Syrian reactor in the Syrian desert. You know, President Bush asked the Israelis not to do this, and they, you know, and then we woke up the next morning and it was gone. And we're kind of, you know, in the intelligence side, we're kind of laughing about this. So it's not unknown for the Israelis to take action based on, you know, what serves their own interests. And so I guess the question from you, if you were sitting in your old seat, and there was there's certainly a request from the administration for the Israelis not to go forward with this. How does that work then? In you know, if you were sitting there and you had to, you know, pick up the phone and call your Israeli counterparts, you know, that because there is some sensitivity on that. You want to follow U.S. policy, but you also have to understand that the Israelis are going to go, you know, and conduct activities based on their own interests.
Absolutely right. You make a good point. The 2000 bombing, and before that, they struck in Iraq, and President Reagan told them not to do it, and then afterward somewhat scolded them for doing it. So we shouldn't be surprised if they take this opportunity. Historical precedent would indicate that they might. You know, if I was sitting in my old seat, then obviously I'm taking the direction of the White House. I have my say, but ultimately it is the policy, especially something as significant as this coming from the president at the White House. And it's clear that they are ready to defend Israel to the end, you know, ironclad, but they do not want to see this escalate. So I think I would be trying to work, and I did this quite a bit, but work with my Israeli counterparts to come up with something that somehow fit a response that doesn't allow this paradigm to stand, right? They could just, okay, we hit we hit essentially a cabal of IRGC officers with Hezbollah officers, and somehow it's now okay to take what could have been catastrophic attacks against civilian infrastructure, quite frankly. They claim it was just an airbase, but that's not, we can see where they were headed. That would be, you know, maybe they could do something on the defense industrial side, like hit a bunch of facilities that build drones, because they could directly tie it to what was shot at them. Maybe just industrial base, period. Maybe, I don't know, petroleum industry type stuff. But of course, I'm sure the U.S. wouldn't like to see that. Maybe they would, but, you know, when it comes to the price of oil, et cetera. So I would try to mitigate that. And if it was clear to me that they were going to say, hey, thanks, understand, but we're going to take the opportunity to hit all these suspected nuclear facilities, because we both publicly state nonstop that it's unacceptable to have a nuclear armed Iran. It's got to have some tooth to that. Then I would turn to on the policy side, trying to do my best to mitigate this potentially escalating. Now it's way easier said than done, but talking to allies, trying to get them at least to understand that this is coming. I think the Israelis might ask us for direct military support. It's clear for me from listening to the White House that we won't do it, but without getting into details, it does substantially increase the likelihood of success if the United States is involved. But in order for it to be really successful, you know, it would have to be pretty substantial. It's not just flying and hitting the actual facility. You have to mitigate substantially the air defense, and that would be right. So I don't know if that they're going to try to do it this time. It's different than striking in Syria. It's different than striking in Iraq to our last precedents. This would be a major military operation that these Iranians would definitely feel like they have to. So I think I would obviously take the guidance of the president trying to have him take a win. And I'd also, of course, you know, going to our backgrounds, I'd say, hey, every facility you know of the IRGC in Syria and potentially even Yemen.
It's game on, right?
Certainly, 100%.
That, yeah.
No problem with that. You know, I'd probably start there. And then if they felt they had to, maybe even, you know, focusing them on the production facilities of these weapons that they're such a big threat. You could even, you know, project it like some think the Iranians did, so that there would be minimal casualties. You just have to balance that as how they're doing. Are they sending missiles? Are they using, you know, manned aircraft? Because manned aircraft, you know, I'm not going to put my people at risk. But anyway, that's probably where I would be going right now. And I'm sure that's what's happening.
So let's kind of switch focus just a little bit now to something I know is near and dear to your heart. It's something that everyone has kind of an act two in their life journey. You had a hell of a career. Actually, you've had several. I think this might be act four. Let's see, the Marine Corps, the agency, DOD. But now you really have dedicated a good bit of your life, and you got a lot more to go. So, you know, you're only in your 50s right now. But ultimately is on the humanitarian side. And so, you know, it's come out in public. I keep kind of texting you every time I see your name associated with the building of the pier in Gaza. I think what you all are doing, just my own kind of two cents, is incredibly admirable. There's certainly concern over the danger involved, but this is pretty important what you're up to. And you have been hesitant. I've seen you on some other shows and podcasts to kind of go into great detail on that. So I certainly respect that. But tell us what exactly is going on. You know, you've been outed on this now, so you can't hide on that anymore. But what are you all doing? What are the prospects for success? And of course, just in the very near term, you know, what does these tensions between Israel and Iran mean for the building of the pier?
Well, thanks for saying that, brother. But this is still an ongoing thing. So you're right. I'm hesitant because one person is part of a bigger team, and we haven't started. So I will talk more about what's going on, to your point. Obviously been outed, and certainly come back and talk much more open, because it's the policy of the whole effort not to get ahead of our skis, as ultimately what's important is this happens. So as you know, famine is essentially on the verge, if not declared, in northern Gaza. And the IPC that came out a couple of weeks ago, most people believe that it's already tilted into famine. they just will not issue another report unless they can get people on the ground. And it's too dangerous to get people on the ground to do the assessment, right? So you see the issue there. And so the group that I was involved with, which is again, a part of a broader effort, did come up with a plan to bring aid at scale. So large amounts of aid into northern Gaza in places that are hard to access right now via the ground route. Now, from our perspective, the answer isn't whether you should do air, ground, or maritime, is you should be doing all of it, right? You're in a famine state. And if you think about it, before the war even started on October 7th, 67% of the population relied on food. Now 100% relies on food, and there's zero capacity to create it. And they're getting a fraction of what they needed. And before, they actually had equal amounts of commercial food, right, which is zero now. So the effort, just generally speaking, isn't to a point where we could do a maritime corridor. The international community is looking at how to fund this. If it's funded, again, not just us, but certainly many other humanitarian organizations. And if we're functioning, we take, which is funded, we take everybody's aid in at zero cost. And we're just a mechanism. It's going to be done under the principles of the UN, done under the auspices of the humanitarian community. We're just, I think because of our background, some people give us a little more credit, but essentially we're just figuring out the maritime part of this. But on the other part of your question, after this, that's when the United States decided to dedicate this pier, also called JLOTS in military terminology. It is a very substantial contribution to this. It's in the process of being getting to the Eastern Mediterranean, and then it'll be set up. Their original date is shifted a bit to the right, so it's somewhere at the beginning of May. Once that's up, we and others will be able to use that to bring aid at scale continuously onto another part of a hard to reach area. We're not giving out the locations for obvious reasons. We don't want to get targeted by Hamas. We are assisting with that. There's a lot of force protection issues, as you might, I'm sure you know. We might be able to do things to mitigate our folks from that potential risk, because as you and I both know, Hamas is way more worried about themselves than the people of Gaza, and would do anything to stop this, even though it's simply bringing food, water, and medicine to people in Gaza. So there's an issue there. And the last part of this, because this current exchange, which can continue, I think they're determining whether the JLOTS will continue right now. I hope it does. But, you know, I can say if I was in the Pentagon, this would certainly be a point of discussion rather than just continuing on like there's nothing going on with this. It's still very much needed, but it does increase the calculus when it comes to the policy here. So I think there's going to be a review of this today. Hopefully it does continue. But if the exchange starts going back and forth and this turns into a regional conflict, I mean, it's going to make the situation in Gaza, unfortunately.
You know, one of the interesting things, you know, we saw that the Israelis went back to school today. I mean, these are obviously pretty, I think they're pretty significant measures. I'm teaching virtually teaching a class to an Israeli university on kind of intelligence tomorrow. And they just texted me and they said, it's on. Well, that's a good sign. You also have an Israel Passover is coming up, in which you have millions of Israelis who travel. And so there is a sense of normalcy that is coming back. So perhaps that's airspace has been opened. Perhaps that's a good thing. But one of the things that I followed this very closely. Obviously, I knew for some time of your involvement in this. And again, I do think that, you know, you are downplaying it, but the unique nature or the unique makeup of your team, where it's, you know, former intelligence, former special operations, former UN, you know, people who do kind of the real relief work. I think that certainly builds an element of trust on both sides. That you all are serious, and frankly, you know, trust with the Israeli side is important because how much they actually distrust the UN. But you know, I also have been following some of the naysayers in the media, on this. And you know, some of it, of course, is kind of reflexible. Okay, if the Israelis would open up, you know, the land routes, this wouldn't be necessary. But the force protection side of it, this is more kind of from our old tribe. People are actually very concerned on that. And I think that, you know, the in terms of doing the right thing, everybody remembers the suicide bombing at HKIA in Kabul. And that's the great fear. And I guess the you probably can't tell the details of this, but I would imagine that you all would not be going forward if you didn't have really significant force protection measures. Would that be correct?
Yes, and it's constantly being developed, right? So I don't want to get into specifics, but what we could do potentially, and we have a very strong partner on the ground, right? It's not American, it's a Palestinian, right? There's potential for us to be able to create a space which would give the force protection standoff that they need to get this in place. And then, of course, and I don't want to give any of their details away, obviously, they wouldn't be on the beach. And of course, the Israelis have to approve this, to your point. This isn't something that's being forced on them. They, in my experience so far, are all about it. They're like, well, start. And so they would also be there for security. In a space that is consistent with the way the UN does not like to have them on top of humanity. There's a lot of political stuff. We are apolitical, but we have to deal with it. And now, you know, from the last report that I saw, the UN doesn't want to use the JLOTs, partly because they would like to use whatever leverage they think they have to try to get the Israelis to open more ground entry points. Again, we're not against ground entry points. We're all the above. But the problem is, to be frank, we also have the U.S. Pushing a pier from Virginia to Gaza. And you could say, wow, that's kind of, Leroy Jenkins-like, right? Like, do something, do it now, right? But that's America. But, you know, on the flip side, I've talked to plenty of people who gave us a little grief for, like, you know, this kind of, they're not doing anything. So I talk to a lot of countries that just talk and then criticize, you know, the United States for doing this. And it's at least we're doing something. And yes, if it's in place, it will be significant. And I do understand the force protection issues. I think they're totally valid concerns. But yes, that is the big issue right now. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay. Well, I will just say that I think that many of us are rooting for you. Again, with force protection, you know, concerns, of course, paramount. I think what you all are doing is very noble. And again, having the background, at least I know who's involved in this. I think it certainly can make a difference. So we'll see how it goes in the days ahead. I'm going to let you go in a sec. I know you have some other media and responsibilities. You're very kind of joining us. But we got to do 2 minutes on something that I know that kind of you practice and believe in your life. Of course, I have to go back with my last name, Polymeropoulos. So I love this, but talk to us about what stoicism means to you, and how you learned about this, how you practice it. I think it's pretty cool. Of course, I'm biased here. So what does stoicism mean to Mick Mulroy?
Yes, I think I should be an honorary Greek by my lifelong connection to it. So my dad decided to teach ethics and morality through philosophy, right? Primarily, you know, ancient Greek philosophy. And stoicism was what I think he gravitated to the most, and obviously I did. And it is Socrates himself would have been the godfather of stoicism. But stoicism basically started almost at the same time as democracy, right? So it's almost hand in glove by a guy named Zeno. And I'm not going to run through the whole thing, but it's important to know how it started, right? So he was a really wealthy guy. He had his fleet of ships that were passing near Piraeus, which, as you know, is the port city of Athens. And they sunk in a storm. And he went from like rich dude to dude that just has cloak, right? And he happened to come up in Piraeus, and he heard somebody talking about Socrates, who had already died by then, and found out it was executed by then. Found out it was one of his students. And he said, where do I find such men? And the bookstore seller pointed at him, and he followed him to Athens. And that's how Stoicism started. And Stoicism itself is really three parts. It Right now, they focus mostly on the ethics, but it started where living with nature was a key component. And it's not just standing in the woods, right? Which is nothing wrong with, but it's actually, you know, understanding that we are just part of a much bigger thing. And that had to do with the concept of their creator, etc. It was very much a holistic perspective spiritually, if you will. It's not a religion, obviously, but you could be religious or irreligious and still be very much knowing. The other part was a strong belief in science. You know, they just referred to it as physics at the time, but that everybody should have a knowledge of science, not just scientists, right? Not that you had to spend all your time doing it, but it was a poor part. And the third really big part was living a good life. You know, eudaimonia is the kind of like, if you could, even though they developed separately, Buddhism and Stoicism, it's a similar concept to nirvana, but eudaimonia is a concept in Stoicism that if you live a righteous life of virtue, you know, justice, wisdom, courage, and self-discipline, that you don't need anything else, right? You don't need fancy cars or fancy houses. They're not anti-wealth, but they completely dismiss it as your value as a person. And I think, you know, part of it, because they started with cynicism before Zeno moved to his own. But to what it's meant to me, it's followed me through childhood. It's into the military. A large component of the military considers itself Stoic. And as soon as they learn about Stoicism, realize that that's what they are. And then I had the privilege of serving with Secretary Mattis, who's probably one of the most well-known modern Stoics, carries a copy of Meditations, Marcus Aurelius is the reason why people are so familiar with that and interested in it is it wasn't meant to be published, right? So it wasn't a book that he wrote that he wanted everybody to think about himself. He wanted it to be burnt, right? But he focused on being a good man, a guy who was the emperor of Rome, potentially the most powerful man that ever lived. And instead of having all the wine and women and whatever he wanted, he was hard on himself for being hard sometimes on his subjects and how he needed to. So to me, it's been something that has helped me my whole life. And quite frankly, it's also one of those things that, you know, I would appreciate somebody who's a good person, just a good person. And even somebody who's a bad person that owns it, I don't appreciate it. But what I don't like is hypocrites, you know? So what I really don't like. I don't really like a bad person who's bad, but and this is one of those things that if you become, it becomes part of your life, whether you're a 3 going to a 4 or a 7 going to an 8, you're going in the right direction as a human being. And so what I have seen, and you know, what I have seen people who join, they start looking at life differently and they start becoming better people because they've committed to becoming better people. And unless they want to say one thing and do another, which most people don't, they have a conscience that's just like, eh. By committing to it, you go in the right direction. And like I said, you could be a religious person and be a Stoic. There's been plenty. In fact, early Christianity was very heavily influenced by Stoicism, which obviously came before it. Or you could be a non-religious person. But I think it's really, you know, when I first started, nobody knew what I was talking about. I grew up in a rural town in Georgia, and you know, people would say, you know, what religion are you? And I'd say Stoicism. And they'd be like, that's some branch of Presbyterian or something. You know, now anybody here in rural Montana, you say Stoicism, they go, oh yeah, I listened to, you know, the Daily Stoic. I've got the new book on Aurelius. So it's good to see. And I hope it stays this way. I hope it's just not a trendy thing that comes and goes.
No, that's awesome. And I was saying, I know you got to run right now, but I am nominating you as an honorary Greek.
Oh, yes. And I'm supposed to be going to a Stoic conference this month, but I think I'm going to be in town.
We're going to call you Mick Mulroyopoulos.
I like it. I'll take that.
Thanks so much, Mick. That's awesome. That's all the time we have today. Again, I want to thank you for coming on. Please do come back when you're back from the region and this really noble cause you're doing with the peer. I want to thank everyone out there once again for listening. DSR will be back later this week with more of our regularly scheduled podcasts. And we hope you'll join us for them. And then join me once again for the Above Average Intelligence Show next Monday. Mick, thanks so much. God bless, safe travels, and great seeing you.
Thanks, brother. Always great seeing you. Great talking to you, man.
Thank you for listening to Above Average Intelligence, hosted every week by Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf. Above Average Intelligence is a production of the DSR Network and was produced by Riley Fessler.